Highs again in the mid 60s.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls on the Radio Northwest Network. We endeavor to serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And there is a lot to talk about. I will get to more about yesterday's huge ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco and its implications for both Seattle and Portland. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And about that Ninth Circuit Court decision, and there is a lot to say about it. Now that the appeals court says Donald Trump can deploy the National Guard, should he send them to troubled American cities? And my answer to that is absolutely yes. And the idea that any lower court judge, you know, one of the junior league, low rent federal district judges, the ones who have jobs for life and are accountable to absolutely nobody. Yeah, those people are the ones who made the decision. Trump's not allowed to do that. And it was kind of ridiculous that they made the decision in the first place. And then when a usually fairly liberal appeals court like the Ninth Circuit says, nope, you got that one wrong. And they not only said you got that wrong, but a bit later, I'm going to tell you what they wrote in that decision. That was a very pointed message aimed at the lower court judges saying you did this one wrong. And the appeals court doesn't often do that. But now that the appeals court says Trump can deploy the National Guard, should he send them to troubled American cities? I'd answer that one yes. The X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Hey, add one more thing to things that the Pacific Northwest is number one in America for in the category where you don't want to be number one in this. Now, there are a number of things that are like that. Highest taxes in America, or nearly the highest taxes in America, nearly the highest gasoline costs in America, highest homeless populations. I mean, lots and lots of bad things. But consider this. The state of Oregon now has the highest rate of mental illness in all the 50 states, even if you include the District of Columbia, and D.C. has its share of crazy people. But I'm going to cite a work from an Oregon Journalism Project report. They did a fantastic job, and they pointed out something, and this really should be disturbing. So the state of Oregon has said, we have a lot of problems with mental illness. And I understand it's terrible if you have somebody in your household that has a mental illness. Worse still, if that mental illness has now led to that person living on the streets, and oftentimes drugs are involved. So the state of Oregon has spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars over the last few years. And if you ask me, well, Lars, if you spend that kind of money, surely you've made some kind of progress. Well, actually, they haven't. The Oregon Journalism Project points out that despite the hundreds of millions of dollars, well, access to care is improved, but mental illness is just as high. And state of Oregon is now number one among the 50 states in the rate of mental illness. And Governor Tina Kotek, well, she has a mentally ill spouse, also an alcoholic spouse, so apparently she knows the problem well. She said she committed herself to battling the state's persistent mental health challenges. Problem is, nothing much is getting done, although that describes most of Kotek's endeavors other than tax raising, which she's very, very good about. The Mental Health America's newly released 2025 report shows that 30% of the entire state's population is mentally ill. So as you walk down the street, About one person in every three you walk by has some kind of mental illness. The study also ranks Oregonians, the report says, both youth and adults, as having the highest prevalence of mental health challenges among the residents of 50 states and the District of Columbia. Now, why hasn't the money worked? Well, the money made a bit of difference because the state was ranked 21st in access to mental health care just a few years ago, 5 years ago. 21st isn't bad because Oregon usually ranks about the middle on many of these issues. So they've gone all the way up to number 7. So they're spending a ton of money on mental health services, but it's apparently not changing the situation for the people with the mental illness. Now, when the Oregon Journalism Project took a hard look at this, and I applaud the reporter who did this for OJP, they found that Oregon has been above average in mental health problems since 2015. So it's been a decade of mental illness, and it's getting worse. Oregon's current rate, 30%, is significantly higher than the national rate at 23%. And what's the problem? It's because Oregon, while spending a ton of money, has what's described by Dr. George Keepers, who's chair of the Oregon Health and Science University Department of Psychiatry. He says you've got a fragmented mental health system. So you pour a lot of money into a badly run system. Hey, badly run systems and state government, who can think of a few more examples of that? The state of Oregon manages to fail at just about everything it does. Public education is bad. University education, bad. Taxes, high. Gasoline costs, expensive, etc. Here's what Keepers said. The county is the mental health authority in Oregon. What happens is counties decide what's going to happen in one jurisdiction or another jurisdiction, and that can be wildly different from one place to another. He prefers, believe it or not, Taxachusetts, because in Taxachusetts, the delivery of care statewide is coordinated in one place. That state ranks number 6 for mental health well-being, so they're doing very, very well. Oregon is number 1 at being very bad at mental health. Now, I get emails almost every week from somebody. In fact, I got one today from a mom who said, look, my son has mental health problems. Can you help me figure out where to take him? The problem is there isn't one answer to that question. What you have is lots and lots of money being spent and not much actually being accomplished with it. If that reminds you of some other problems, like, let's say, drug addiction, where you have a huge amount of money being spent, not much gets done about it. How about homelessness? In the state of Oregon, homelessness has one of the highest rates per capita in the United States of America. You have more homeless people, and in fact, homeless people flock to the Pacific Northwest because, I believe, they've found that Oregon and Washington are an easy touch. We've got easy welfare. We've got easy government services. There are non-governmental organizations that are spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and they're giving most of it away. You need a new tent. You need a new tarp. You need some new needles to shoot up your heroin. You can get all of it free of charge. No judgment whatsoever. And of course, it's all low barrier shelters, meaning you can keep on shooting heroin and still live in a public shelter. And when it comes to mental health, they spend a lot of money. They don't get a lot done. Glad to have your phone calls and your emails, of course. It is the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I honestly keep wondering when voters in the Pacific Northwest will figure out that they've elected governments that do not have their best interests in mind. Lawmakers passed the biggest tax hike in state history in Oregon. They did the same thing in Washington state last year. Governor Kotek this year refuses to sign that new law for another 3 weeks. That way she can keep citizens from putting it to a vote. They budgeted $1.2 billion to fund health insurance for illegal aliens. Can anybody, even a naysayer, tell me exactly how that benefits the people of the state of Oregon? Governor Kotek blew a gasket when Homeland Security threatened to shut down the nightly riots that have been torturing the school and the residential neighborhood near the ICE headquarters. The mayor of Portland seems content to let the noise and the riots and the arrests go on indefinitely. It's burning up a tremendous amount of resources when it comes to police and emergency services. Portland Public Schools failed to teach kids how to read, write, or do math, but now they're building brand new high schools at $500 million each. Some of the most expensive high schools anywhere in the United States of America, and it's far more space than the kids actually need. They're actually building one high school at 1,700 student capacity that only has about 400 students right now, and the forecasts are the student population is going to go down, not up. Oregon has hit the top ranks for taxes, gas prices, mental illness, homeless shanties, and a whole lot of other things that you don't want to be number one in. Does any of that suggest that our elected leaders have your best interests in mind? Because it certainly doesn't do it for me. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can also vote in our X poll. Now, we put up a brand new poll question every single day out of the news of the day. Late yesterday, we found out that in San Francisco, a notoriously liberal appeals court had decided that, yes, President Trump can deploy the National Guard to Portland or, frankly, any other city he wants to send them to. Should the president then send the National Guard to troubled cities? My answer to that is yes. You can answer the question any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Trudy Black writes in, Lars, I've heard frequently on your show you've spoken with people that do rehab centers without patient care. I'm trying to get help for my son-in-law. It's been challenging to find a place. Would you be able to give me some information for at least a starting point? I appreciate your show and what you do. Ms. Black, I wish I had a simple answer for you, but I really don't. And the fact is, as I've just discussed, the state of Oregon and the state of Washington have been spending huge amounts of money on mental health care. It's very popular because liberal Democrat governors have decided they love to give money for that sort of thing to non-governmental organizations and also to health care institutions. Those institutions all make out like bandits. Does it actually do much good for people in terms of mental health? Not so very much. And my favorite request from a listener, hey, Lars, please talk about the recall initiative to recall Governor Tina Kotek, our governor every day. I signed the initiative over the weekend. It's a tall issue, but I hope the people in Multnomah County are listening. Thanks for keeping up the fight. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill, and it takes a little bit of explanation, but it's so bizarre you almost can't imagine it. I want to give it to the institutionalized racism that is practiced by woke folks here in the Pacific Northwest. A perfect example of this. A brand new federal lawsuit was filed yesterday. It was filed by a parent of a child in public school. And it alleges that, in this case, Portland Public Schools, although I don't have any reason to believe that Seattle or Eugene or Tri-Cities or Spokane is much different, that they have engaged in race-based discrimination by using a staffing formula that partly prioritizes more full-time employees for schools with higher percentages of students who are Black, Hispanic, Native American, or Pacific Islander. The lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court by a legal team that includes a former state lawmaker represents a significant challenge to what Portland Public Schools call equity funding. In other words, they believe in this stuff. Now, think about it this way. Let's say you've got a school that is filled mostly with white kids. They're going to get less staff. If you have a school that is more people of color, students of color, they're going to get more staffing. Now, is it based on the need of the students in those schools? No. It's based on the assumption that if you're a student of color, you, of course, must be having a tough time in school. And if you're a white kid, you have no problems with school. You sail right on through. And where I think it produces a really bizarre result, that means that if you're a student of color, but you go to a predominantly white school, your school is going to be understaffed by Portland Public Schools so they can shift the staff over. So it has to do with deciding the kids in this school are in trouble because there's a large percentage of students of color. The kids in that school still has brown kids and black kids, but they're not having any problem at all because they go to school with white kids. Can you imagine what twisted, perverse thinking that is? It means that there may be kids in predominantly white schools that are kids of color, students of color, and they're having a tough time with school. They could use some extra help. They get shortchanged. There could be kids, both brown kids, black kids, and white kids, that are going to predominantly minority schools, and they're doing just fine. But they're going to get extra staffing for no particular reason. If that actually makes sense to anybody, let me know. I hope that the lawsuit is successful. I hope that they say we're going to give the same staffing to all schools, whether they are white schools or whether they're brown and black schools. All kids deserve an equal shot. Portland Public Schools does not believe in that. Our best email of the day so far, you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. It's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP-THAT. So the man who signs himself your fellow American John says, those complaining about Donald Trump's strikes on the cartel drug boats violating the rules of combat, due process, human rights, and the Constitution, they all seem to forget that presidents have been conducting strikes on terrorist organizations going all the way back to Obama and further. What's the difference between a jihadist that kills 10 Americans with a gun or a smuggling operation that kills the same number of Americans with a drug overdose? One is less noticeable and done for profit. If you're smuggling illegal substances into the United States and it kills Americans, the only right you have is the right to get blown up. Signed, your fellow American, John. I think John's absolutely right. Almost a daily basis, I get calls from people who say, well, they're not giving those poor drug runners due process. They should pull them over in the middle of the open ocean in international waters and take them into custody and then bring them back to America, where I'm sure they would end up with an ACLU attorney and a lot of defenders, the way Kilmer Abrego Garcia found all of his friends in the Democrat Party. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, it appears that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the most overturned appeals courts and usually fairly liberal, has now cleared the way for President Trump to deploy the National Guard and send them to American cities, in particular to Portland, because that's the place he's been talking about sending them first before they say go to Chicago or many of the other big blue cities that have had problems. And now this the appeals court has actually not just slapped down the opponents of Trump and said, yes, the president has that authority to call up the National Guard, and yes, he can send them where he believes that there's trouble, and he needs to have that trouble taken care of because that's a federal role. But the Ninth Circus Court also sent a memo to the lower courts, basically slapping them down for not deciding the case on a reasonable basis. On that note, I want to bring on Michael O'Neill, who's Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Lars. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Isn't this an easy call to say, does the commander-in-chief have the authority to call the National Guard, and can he send them wherever he thinks that there might be a federal issue involved?
Right. This is an easy call, particularly in Portland and Chicago. We could talk about what's happened in Chicago at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, but in Portland, we're talking about the deployment of 200 National Guard troops to provide operational security to ensure that those federal facilities, that federal building in Portland, is secure. Now, generally speaking, in normal times, you'd have the Portland Police Department and Portland law enforcement ensuring that the blocks and the areas surrounding those federal buildings are secure. Of course, that's not happening because of the political situation, obviously, in Portland. There's no desire or political will to ensure that that area is secure. So the president has had to invoke this section of the statute and say that I'm going to deploy a limited. Now, let's be clear. If you hear from the left, you'd think that they're moving in the 101st Airborne and the 1st Armored Division up the streets through Portland. It's 200 federal national troops, National Guard troops, to provide operational security to ensure that the Antifa insurrectionists don't pose a violent threat to not only the building but federal personnel as well. So it's a limited deployment. It's necessary, and of course, as you said earlier, the president has essentially almost a very, very strong authority here. He's operating at the height of his powers. This is enforcement of federal law consistent with his Article II powers.
By the way, Michael, I'm glad you used that bit of hyperbole about the 101st Airborne. Do you remember when a president sent the 101st Airborne to an American city? Of course you do. Would you tell my audience?
Yeah, of course. That was during the desegregation case in 1957 when President Eisenhower had to work. Again, this was a Democrat governor who was refusing to integrate the school system. So there was the deployment of the 101st Airborne Division to ensure schools were desegregated. The segregated schools were desegregated back in the Civil Rights era.
And I'm sure at the time there were probably people said, this is a school matter. These are little kids, brown and black kids that were told you can't go to school with the white kids. And the president sending the 101st Airborne, and yet a Republican president has said, yep, I've got to straighten out that Democrat governor. It seems that Democrats are behind a lot of this trouble that comes. I want to ask you about something else, though, because I think ordinarily aren't the appeals courts, they'll decide a case and say if the lower courts got it right or not. But how often do they say something like this? This is from the ruling in favor of Trump. Rather than reviewing the president's determination with great deference, the district court substituted its own determination of the relevant facts and circumstances. Will you decode that for my non-lawyer audience? And for me, I'm a non-lawyer, too.
So several months ago, Newsom versus Trump out of the Ninth Circuit. This isn't the first time that this court has had to address this issue. But remember, President Trump deployed National Guard troops to Los Angeles to quell that insurrection that was arising. The Ninth Circuit, of course, held the same court of appeals, probably a different panel, but the same court held that the president has that authority to deploy. Again, he's deploying troops to ensure National Guard troops to ensure secure operational security. And again, this is the court expressing its frustration that it's having to, again, slap down a district court who is operating well beyond its authority, its Article III authority, infringing on this Article II authority of the president. Again, I would argue that this is a non-justiciable issue, that a court doesn't really ever have even jurisdiction to question whether the president has determined that he needs to use that the security situation has deteriorated to the point that he needs to mobilize National Guard troops to protect federal buildings. I would argue, as a case initially, that that's not even something that a federal court should be able to question the president on. Alternatively, if you want to argue, okay, well, let's look at the facts. Great deference should be given to the president who makes that determination because he is fully apprised of the facts on the ground. It's not for a judge to come in and say, oh, maybe the security's okay today, but who knows what it's going to be tomorrow? Who knows what it was last week? But right now it's okay, so we're going to say that the president doesn't have this authority. Keep in mind, this is in order to execute federal law enforcement duties. This is the preeminent duty of the president, and judiciary should be loath to interfere in these sorts of cases.
Well, and in fact, we've heard a lot of talk from the people and the officials in Portland saying, we're going to demand an en banc. We're going to get 11 judges instead of three, and that'll get a different result. Or we may even take it to the Supreme Court. Now, I realize lawyers are loath to say, make predictions about what the courts will do. But does any of this change if they get 11 judges from the Ninth Circuit Court?
Possibly. It's funny because, you know, everybody talks about the Ninth Circuit as being a liberal jurisdiction, a liberal circuit. It's really kind of evolved over the past few years. President Trump has the opportunity in his first term to put a lot of judges on that court. So you really are getting a fair shake in front of the Ninth Circuit. I would think that an en banc panel would support. Again, from my perspective, the legal case is open and shut. Interestingly, it is in front of the Supreme Court in a different context. The Seventh Circuit, if you can recall, the Seventh Circuit, opposite of what the Ninth Circuit did, the Seventh Circuit affirmed a temporary restraining order issued by a district court. So the Seventh Circuit did say prevented the deployment of National Guard troops in Chicago, for example. This happened about a week ago. So that case is right in front of the Supreme Court. Briefing actually finished yesterday. So you can expect a decision out of the Seventh Circuit. From that Seventh Circuit decision from the Supreme Court, probably this week, Lars. So you might get a Supreme Court decision that's going to affect that en banc issue now.
Hold on, just to translate that for my audience. Does that mean if the U.S. Supreme Court says the Seventh Circuit was wrong, overrules their decision, says, yes, the president can send troops to Chicago, does that moot the entire case in the Ninth Circuit and say, yep, and it's all, he also has the right to send him to Portland?
Yeah, well, I don't want to get too legalistically here. It depends on what the court says. Playing devil's advocate here, you could argue that the factual circumstances in Chicago are different from the factual circumstances in Portland. In other words, the factual predicate was met by the Department of Justice in justifying the deployment in Portland, whereas in Chicago, they didn't meet that factual predicate. On the other hand, the court could say what I was initially saying. This is not justiciable at all. We don't want to get involved in this. The president has the authority to do this. We're not going to get involved. Yes, he can deploy these troops. Everything is mooted. So it's really going to depend on what the court says. But certainly the Ninth Circuit's going to be taking a very close look at what the Supreme Court does this week. Incidentally, you do have a split in circuits currently. You have the Seventh Circuit issuing one thing, the Ninth Circuit issuing the other. And so it's incumbent and it's imperative that the Supreme Court weigh in on this, albeit on an emergency expedited basis. But it's imperative that they weigh in on this sooner rather than later so we don't have these inconsistent applications throughout the country.
Do you want to make a prediction as to what the 6-3 split is going to do in Washington?
Yeah, they're going to stay the Seventh Circuit. I'm in favor of. Look at the justices of the Supreme Court have been doing, how they've been trending in generally all these cases. They're going to say, I don't know, I won't go so far as to say it's totally out of the hands of the courts, because again, they're reluctant to necessarily take away jurisdiction from the courts in these cases. But they're going to say that the president is entitled to extreme deference in making these factual determinations. And therefore, if it's reasonable that he determines that the security situation has deteriorated to the point that they need to deploy National Guard troops, albeit in this limited manner, then the president has the authority to do this.
Very good. That's Michael O'Neill, Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. I expect I'm going to get some naysayers on this. Glad to have you with me. You're listening to The Lawrence Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey there,
Ad Council.
Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? Hello, Jim. All right, well, Jim just lost his opportunity. So there you go. I do want to talk about something involving schools and schedules, because now, get this, teachers in the Northwest, some of them, are now, through their unions, arguing that we ought to divert them from even more classroom time. And I'll tell you this, Oregon has the reputation, Washington State to some extent, but Oregon is one of the worst when it comes to the amount of time that your kids get with their teachers. In other words, throughout America, the number of days in a school year will vary somewhat. But then the number of hours of instruction that each kid gets is going to vary from state to state. Oregon has one of the lowest numbers when it comes to the amount of time, the number of hours that your kids get with a teacher. And if you take a close look, this is where I get myself in trouble with some teachers, because I've described their jobs as part-time jobs, and I get a lot of heat for that. Let me explain why I say that. Because the teachers' union contract, which is the contract under which teachers work, says our members will work this many days every year and this many hours, 1,500 hours a year. But out of those 1,500 hours, if you're not familiar, a regular work year for everybody else in America is 2,000 hours. 1,500 hours is three-quarter time. Now, if you told somebody, I just got a full-time job, really? Well, you should be able to pay your bills. No, I really can't, because I only work 1,500 hours a year. So in other words, you work a quarter less than everybody else who describes themselves as part-time, as full-time. And then you say, but of those 1,500 hours, how many do you actually spend in front of the children teaching them? Well, out of every eight-hour day, union contracts, and they vary a little bit in the Northwest, but not much, about 5 hours and 15 minutes of every eight-hour day is spent with the kids, which kind of puts the lie to the, you know, the idea their teachers will say, well, I'm working to midnight every night. Well, your union contract says you're on the job, on the clock, 8 hours a day, and you only teach just over 5 hours of those 8 hours. You have 2 hours and 45 minutes for prep or grading papers or whatever it is you want to do out of the 8 hours. That doesn't count your lunch hour. So you're already talking about kids who aren't getting a lot of time in front of the teacher. And now, get this, this is the latest proposal. A staff memo, this one's at Portland Public Schools, on required instructional time for students, includes a future consideration for the school board. The memo proposes that the board might vote to consider an exemption that would count up to 30 hours of teacher professional development time as instructional time for the students, about 1 week of instructional time. So in other words, the kids who are already getting shortchanged on the number of days in the school year and the number of hours of teaching in every school day are now going to lose 30 more hours, and the teachers are going to use that for professional development, whatever that is. I'm sure in some cases it's very meaningful. I would expect that if you're going to do professional development, because you do consider yourselves a profession, you do it the same way that doctors and lawyers and engineers and all the other people in professions do it. There are lawyers and doctors and accountants and everybody else, all those people in professions who have to go out and do what's called continuing education. Do you think they get to go to their clients and say, by the way, I'm going to bill you for the time I spend at this weekend seminar because it's CE credits for me and I have to bill it to somebody? No, it's on their time. They want to chop another week of instructional time out. The Oregon Department of Education Director, Dr. Charlene Williams, recently noted that Oregon students see some of the shortest school years in America, a problem she highlighted, and now they're talking about cutting out one more week. Does that sound like you're getting your money's worth when you pay all those taxes that support the record amount of money, about $18,000 per year per student that is spent on public education? Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Lars. I wanted to get your read on a thought I had regarding the shutdown by the Democrats. Idea being they can't take responsibility for their own actions, and they should. And it's almost like Flip Wilson's character Geraldine, the devil made me do it. They got to take responsibility for their own actions. It's part of being an adult.
Yeah, but if you're a Democrat, you get to say, we're the ones who could vote to get the government funded again, because only the Democrats can do that. In the Senate, there are 55 votes in favor of a government funding bill, 55 of them, including Republicans, including Democrats, and including independent members of the U.S. Senate. What would it take to get the government funding approved? 60 votes. We need five more Democrats across the line. And if you say, well, why don't we have five more Republicans? We don't have any more Republicans. All of the Republicans have voted for funding the government. Some of the Democrats, a couple of them, have voted for it, and a couple of the independents, Angus King, among others, have voted to fund the government. So this is entirely within the Democrats' control. And one of the ways, Jim, that they're able to get away with this, and it's a fault of my business, which is the mainstream media. If reporters began going to Democrats saying, how do you justify when your party controls the votes that could make this government funding happen and you refuse to do it? Now, their answer is, well, we've told the Republicans we'll vote for it when they add $1.5 trillion in new spending over the next 10 years. And the Republicans have said, we're not adding anything to the package. And if you want to try and add things, you can't. We will vote a clean continuing resolution or none at all. The Democrats are the ones who shut down the government. They get to own it. Thanks for the call, by the way.
The Lars Larson Show.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Now, when I hear about something crazy that involves aviation, I don't want Chuck to take this the wrong way, but the first name that comes to my mind is commercial airline pilot and meteorologist Chuck Weiss, who joins me now. Chuck has been a reliable source on all of this because he used to fly what they call the heavies, you know, the big jets. And so I can call him up and say, hey, how does something like this happen? So when I saw this story, a passenger on board a United Airlines flight that struck a mystery object at 36,000 feet, remember that number because I think it's significant, forced the jet to make an emergency landing. There was a picture of the pilot's arms just covered with blood because it literally shattered the windshield at the front of the airplane. And this is on a big commercial jet, United Flight 1093 from Denver to Los Angeles. Chuck, welcome back to the program. What in the world do you think happened in this case?
Well, thanks for having me on, Lars. I'm not really sure what object would have hit the aircraft. If I had to speculate, but it's only speculation, I would say that it was probably a piece of ice from another aircraft operating in the vicinity, maybe from a leaky potable water line or something along those lines that can immediately freeze if it falls off or drifts off the aircraft. But that's, again, speculating. I don't know. The important thing is that something hit the upper left windshield of this pilot's aircraft, the Boeing 737 MAX, and it did it severely cracked and shattered at least part of the windshield. And so the significance of that is whether or not you're going to lose pressurization if the cracked windshield couldn't hold pressure. And I don't know whether or not there was a problem with that in the aircraft or not, but regardless, it creates an immediate emergency for the fear that you might completely undo or shatter the rest of the aircraft or the windshield if you didn't descend to a lower altitude, because at altitude, at 36,000 feet where they were, the difference in pressure from the inside to the outside of the cabin is somewhere around 8 to 8.4 pounds per square inch, and that's a lot of loading on the airframe and on any other objects that enclose the outside of the inn. So if you weaken the windshield, there's a chance that that it could be shattered additionally or more damage to cause a pressurization loss. So the first thing they're going to do is declare an emergency with air traffic control, which they did, and then they're going to descend as fast as they can get down to lower altitudes to reduce that pressure difference and also reduce the likelihood that you'd have to deploy oxygen masks or have even a greater emergency if you had a sudden depressurization of the airplane.
By the way, Chuck, you've flown in planes like this, what, hundreds or thousands of times as the pilot in charge in the left seat up front. How strong are those windows? Is there a way of characterizing? Because I know they go through testing.
Yeah, they're very strong. And interestingly enough, you know, one of the things that keeps the windshield pliable, and it's required to go with the operation of the aircraft. In other words, you can't use an MEL or what they call a minimum equipment list to defer windshield heat. to later maintenance on some schedule. It has to go with the operation of the aircraft on every flight. So if the windshield heat is not operating, that immediately grounds the aircraft. And, of course, it becomes a big deal if it fails in flight, too. It's not an emergency without anything cracking, but you can't operate the aircraft without it. And the reason is the windshield heat provides more pliability with that glass frame, so that it, if in the event something like this happens, it reduces the chance of a complete failure. So it obviously was working, and it may have been part of the reason why the pilot might have suffered some burns, because the windshield gets pretty hot when the windshield heat is on, and it also serves to help de-ice the windshield if there's snow or freezing rain or something like that when you're operating in that sort of an environment. So that's what they use with the multiple layers in the windshield to keep it pliable and less likely to shatter if there was an impact with something.
In fact, I've read about the chicken guns they use, where they'll take chickens, not frozen chickens, but chickens, and fire them at the windshields at 350 miles an hour to make sure that you could a plane could survive a bird strike.
Yeah, there's all kinds of testing that Boeing and the aircraft manufacturers do with that, but they do require that you have windshield heat to operate the aircraft, and that's the reason you want the windshield to be more pliable just in case something does strike it. Because at 36,000 feet, the outside air temperature is pretty close to 50 below zero. If you didn't have any heat applied to the windshield, it's going to get mighty cold, and it makes it rigid and less flexible if something hits, and increases the chance of a complete shattering. So that's why it's a required operational feature of the aircraft. But that was amazing. I've never, in all the years I've flown for major carriers and flying jet transports, I've never run across a situation where something hit the aircraft at 36,000 feet. And,
well, the reason I mentioned that number and told people, you know, remember that number, you know, where do you have the greatest likelihood of bird strike? And do you have any amount of chance of hitting a bird at 36,000 feet?
Well, usually the birds are not going to go above between 10 and 15,000. That's about the highest you ever see them when they're migrating or flying around. So the probability of having a bird strike goes up, obviously, the lower the altitude you would descend to. And there are advisories that the air traffic controllers will give if they're aware of the fact that over a certain area you may be landing at or transiting through to get to your destination has birds or reported heavy bird activity in the vicinity, like a runway or something. So there are advisories for that, but the biggest chance of a bird strike is down low, usually right after takeoff or just before landing.
You mentioned the frozen water from a leak from another plane. Is it possible it was space junk? That's the other thing I heard, because we've got something like 25 or 30,000 pieces of junk up in orbit, everything from discarded wrenches or, you know, nuts that spun off a piece of equipment, you know, that was in orbit, or pieces of satellites. Is it possible? I mean, I know statistically unlikely that it would hit, but is it possible that it was a descending piece of space junk?
Yeah, it's always possible. You're just speculating at this point to know for sure exactly what it was. But but whatever it wasn't too large, because you could see the damage pattern on the upper left part of the windshield of the aircraft. That's exactly where it made impact, from the circular pattern that you could see on it. And then it shattered everything outward from there. From the looks of it, the co-pilot had to make the landing in this situation, because I don't think he had much visibility out the windshield that was in front of him that got struck because of all the cracked glass.
That's when the guy in the right front seat, or the gal in the right front seat, is going to have to really earn his paycheck.
Yeah, but they're all trained to the same standards. A co-pilot has just as much ability to fly and pilot that jet as the captain does. The only difference is the captain is the pilot in command, and every decision made regarding the safety of the flight and operation of the flight rests with the captain. So if something goes wrong, he's the first guy that the FAA will be talking to about what happened and why. But,
unbelievable that would happen, though. I mean, to have that hit and hit at exactly that spot, and whether it would have hit somewhere else on the plane and created more damage. That's Chuck Weiss, commercial airline pilot and our meteorologist go-to, especially on issues like global warming and climate change. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the most successful things I've seen the president do, and that's President Donald Trump, is go out and go after the drug dealers. He's tried to deal with Venezuela before. Venezuela keeps on sending its worst. They send Tren de Aragua gang members to America, although those are being rounded up fairly quickly and then deported either to Venezuela or to other countries. But Venezuela is also one of those places that is bringing drugs up. Other countries do as well. So what has the president decided to do? Blow them out of the water. I think we're on boat number 7 by about now. And you know what's funny about this? I think one of Donald Trump's best and most successful endeavors is to get the Democrats to defend the indefensible. That is, they will go out and stand up for illegal aliens, for human traffickers, and even for drug dealers. You've literally got people out there who are saying, oh, no, you have to give all of those drug runners, the ones that are bringing in the drugs like fentanyl and methamphetamine and heroin and cocaine and other dangerous drugs, drugs that are routinely killing close to 100,000 Americans every single year, you've got to give them due process. Why, you should arrest them and bring them back to the United States and give them a taxpayer-funded attorney and give them a trial and due process and appeals and blah-de-blah-de-blah. You know what Donald Trump's decided? Let's just blow them out of the water. And I don't hear a lot of conservative Americans objecting to that. But there are some politicians who've raised some objections, and I'll tell you about those in a moment. First, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And we make a unique offer. That is, if you're a naysayer, you're somebody who say wants to stand up for the due process rights of drug dealers who are trying to bring boatloads, literally boatloads, of fentanyl and other killing drugs into the United States, we put naysayers right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. You can also vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day. Today's question, now that one of the appeals courts, not both, but one of them, has said that Donald Trump can deploy the National Guard, should he send the National Guard to troubled American cities? The Ninth Circuit Court said yes. The Seventh Circuit Court has said no. And so it sounds like it's going to be up to the U.S. Supreme Court to make the ultimate decision, as they usually do. I would say yes. Once he's got the authority, or that authority has been reestablished by the courts, I think presidents have always had that authority. And in fact, presidents like Johnson and Kennedy and Eisenhower have all used that authority, although the mainstream media, most of them in their 20s and 30s, don't seem to remember that this isn't the first time that American presidents have sent the National Guard. And I'll make this distinction. You might say, well, you know, the military was also sent, say, during some of the riots in Los Angeles about 30 years ago. That's true. But that was with the invitation of the states. In the case of Johnson and Kennedy and Eisenhower, those presidents sent military to those states over the objections of the local authorities. Well, now that we have local authorities in places like Chicago and Portland, Oregon, who are standing up and objecting to sending the troops, well, in that case, should the president still do it? One of the appeals courts says he has the authority. The other one says he does not. And I think the Supreme Court is going to decide that the commander in chief has the authority to do that. Let me get back to the drug dealers, though. You can vote in the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, our website. But these lethal military airstrikes on drug smugglers in the Caribbean, well, they've also got a bunch of Democrats in a dither, and even a couple of Republicans, including U.S. Representative Michael Baumgartner, a member of the Republican Party, although I don't know how Republican he is. He's a Republican from Spokane, Washington. Both of them, he and U.S. Rep. Adam Smith, he's been on the program before. He's a Democrat. They say that Congress should have more oversight of the attacks. Now, that's the part where it gets a little strange, because if the president is the commander in chief, I mean, whether it was Bush, one of the Bushes, or Obama, or even Joe Biden, President Otto Penn, if you're the commander in chief, do you have to check in with Congress and get their say-so before you decide to go out and take out a threat to the United States of America? Here's what Baumgartner, allegedly a Republican, says. I don't have a problem with drug smugglers being sent to the bottom of the ocean. So he starts off very well. But he said this just a couple of days ago. He said, I do have concerns about the process. And then Congressman Smith, a Democrat who's the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, says he wants House Speaker Mike Johnson to call the House back into session. I think there's a political motive there that has something to do other than with drug smugglers during the ongoing government shutdown. He says President Trump and his administration continue to fail to answer pressing questions regarding the president's orders to carry out lethal U.S. military strikes on boats in the Caribbean. They have failed to demonstrate the legality of these strikes, provide transparency on the process used, or even a list of cartels that have been designated as terrorist organizations. I frankly don't see the problem, because Donald Trump has already said that Tren de Aragua is a terrorist organization. Antifa is a terrorist organization, although I don't know that Antifa is drug smuggling. But when the president is so very, very public, every time they hit one of these drug smuggling boats, it takes about 10 seconds for the White House to put the video up on social media. So if the congressman, in this case Smith, is saying, we're not being brought into this, we need to know the legality. What is legal? You know, and if you want to take it to court and ask a judge, hey, we'd like to take away control of the military from the commander in chief. What do you suppose that judge, I don't care what level of federal judge they are, what do you suppose they're going to say to the idea that the Congress wants to act as the executive and Congress wants to act as though it has veto power over the commander in chief? I don't think that's going to go anywhere. And as far as due process, you know, when they say we want to see what the plan is and what the authorization is. The authorization is this. President Trump is the commander-in-chief of the United States military. When he identifies a threat against the United States, and I think it's relatively easy to say, having people bring in tons and tons of drugs, which are routinely killing about 100,000 Americans every year, is that a threat to America? Yes. Is there a conventional way to stop that threat? Not really. I mean, if the Democrats are somehow suggesting that if we just arrest some of the people in those boats, meaning the foot soldiers or some of the drug traffickers, the big money guys who are actually making all this happen, and then we're going to put them on trial in America, and a couple of years from now, these people will be found guilty and sent off to prison. If you think that's going to stop the drug smuggling that is coming out of Central and South America, you've got another thing coming. It's not going to happen. I mean, the big drug cartels have lots and lots of foot soldiers to get that job done. The minute you arrest or blow up several of them, they're going to be replaced very, very quickly. So can you stop it through conventional police methods? The answer is no. In fact, these boats are being blown up in international waters. Now, does President Trump have to justify perhaps to the rest of the world and say, we have the information, we know these people are smuggling drugs? I'd be willing to bet that when those drug traffickers are leaving the places where they load up with the drugs, I'm willing to bet the United States has both drones and satellite data that show exactly what's in those boats. They know what's being transported, and when they send it to the bottom of the ocean, that is one of the best places that any drug smuggler or human trafficker can end up. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. In a rocky political climate, he's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Now, I'm trying to keep count. I swear I wish they had a scoreboard to keep track of this. The U.S. Senate has now failed for the 11th time. I hope it's not the 12th. If I've lost count, then I'm in trouble. To end the government shutdown, which is now entering its third week. Is compromise still on the table, or will one side be forced to give in? And let's hope it's the Democrats who are making outrageous demands. Preston Brashears joins me now, a research fellow in tax policy at the Grover Herman Center for the Federal Budget. Mr. Brashears, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars. Thanks so much for having me.
So I think we're on number 11. If we're on 12, I'm happy to be corrected on that. But what is going to end this when the Democrats are saying we're only going to come in and vote for a budget if you give us another $1.5 trillion in spending over the next 10 years? And the Republicans have said, we're not asking for anything extra, just the same budget we've been on, the same one you voted on a dozen times already.
Well, first of all, you're right. It is still 11, at least by my count. But then again, it is very hard to keep track at this point. But it's hard to say, because at this point, it seems like both sides are pretty dug in. I think the Republicans and President Trump are rightfully so, because all they're asking for is to have a clean bipartisan CR. There's a handful of Democrats that have signed on to that, which basically just takes this portion of the government and that we're talking about appropriations here and just continues the level of funding that we've had for the past year. And the Democrats, their counteroffer is, well, even though we're the minority party, we want to have $1.5 trillion of additional spending, things like health insurance for illegal immigrants. We want to bring back some funding for NPR and PBS and all these different things. And so it's difficult to see this necessarily ending anytime soon. I think we've got a little while before either side blinks.
Well, and 35 days is the maximum length of any previous shutdown. So does this one go beyond that? Because on the first of the month, there are a number of things that aren't going to happen, as I understand it. There are certain federal programs that pay out monies like SNAP and social welfare programs, and there are paychecks that have already been missed, and now we're going to miss another one on the first of the month. At what point do the Democrats say, yeah, we tried this, we failed, because they're going to end up with egg on their face, but they may end up with more if they think that all this damage is going to accrue to the Republicans rather than the Democrats. I think the public reads it differently.
Yeah, I mean, Chuck Schumer said every day gets better for us, and I don't think that's the way that the American people necessarily see this, and they don't appreciate that sort of attitude about this. And you're right. I think it's very possible that we end up pushing beyond that 35-day record mark. And I think the longer that it does that, the harder it becomes, and the more downside there is to this. And so the sooner that they do kind of realize that they're not going to win out of this. And I think everything I'm seeing is that this is not, the longer this goes on, it's not what Chuck Schumer thinks. It's not getting better for them. People are seeing the reality. They're seeing that the Republicans have voted 11 times to reopen the government, and the Democrats are standing in the way. So, but at the same time, I think, unfortunately, Chuck Schumer is beholden to the radical wing of the Democrat Party. And the radical wing of the Democrat Party has been itching for a fight with President Trump. And even if it's something like shutting the government down, which you'd think the Democrats wouldn't want to do since they're the party of big government, whatever they can do to have a fight with President Trump, it seems like that's what they're willing to do.
Well, and it almost seems like they thought they could get the Republicans to roll over easily. And honestly, Preston, I was concerned that was going to happen. I mean, Republicans sometimes lack a serious backbone. And yet in this case, I don't see any signs of a crack. And I don't see any signs that the Republican resolve is cracking, that is.
I think that's right. I had the same concerns, because you're right. Usually, you know, the media starts to do a little bit of complaining and some sob stories, and then the Republicans are usually pretty quick to roll over, or they have been in the past. But credit where credit is due, it looks like Senate Majority Leader Thune and Mike Johnson, and they had a meeting in the Rose Garden today with President Trump. It looks like they're providing a united front, and it doesn't seem like there's any strong push to cave into these ridiculous demands.
No, I guess what I'm wondering is, do the Democrats really think at some point the Republicans will say, well, we'll give you half a loaf. We'll give you some funding for illegal aliens for Medicaid. We'll give you NPR, but not PBS. We'll give you some money to expand some, or to continue some of the COVID era expansion of Obamacare. And then we'll trade that, and the Republicans will get something too. The Republicans have been pretty resolved. We're not getting anything extra. And the Democrats are the only ones who are demanding something extra in exchange for their votes. And if they're not going to do it, then we'll just sit here with the government shut down until the Democrats come to the table.
Yeah, I mean, that I totally agree that it's their position is untenable. But it's, I think once you're dug into that position, it's very difficult to walk yourself out of it. And so, maybe the Republicans, I don't think they're going to, cave at this point and give them anything in this, without reopening the government. And at this point, the longer this drags on, I think the more consequences and that the Democrats are going to start to see is this kind of gives more authority to the OMB director to start to make cuts where he deems necessary. Because look, he's now in charge. Congress has effectively, because of the Democrats, reneged on their power over or how to spend the power of the purse, and now it falls on Russ Vogt to kind of figure out where the cuts need to happen to make sure that things keep running on time.
You know, I'd love to talk to some of the Democrat senators about this, but they're not willing to come on. And you and I both look at it from one point of view. But I'm kind of wondering if the argument the Democrats are advancing is saying, well, the Republicans are in charge. They've got Trump in the White House. They've got a bare majority in the House. They've got a majority in the Senate. And so they're running things. Except all of that flies in the face of the fact that the public has had to be educated about the fact that, no, you don't win with 51 votes. You win with 60 votes. And there aren't 60 Republicans. So saying the Republicans are in charge is not true. Not when it comes to one of these votes, is it?
Of course not. I mean, it's basic math. I mean, you're right. They want to say just because the Republicans have the White House, the Senate and the House, they should be able to somehow magically make this happen, even though every one of them is obstructing effectively. How many times have we heard the media call Republicans obstructionists in the past for voting no on something? But here, what we have is the Democrats are filibustering, standing in the way of this, because using the filibuster in the Senate where you need 60 votes, and they don't have 60 votes without a handful more Democrats slipping over and voting for this bipartisan clean CR.
Okay, do you have
consequences?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Do you have any particular Democrats you think might be the ones to cave in, maybe the ones that are up for re-election next year? Because only a third of the Senate comes up every year, but there have to be at least a couple of Democrats that might be worried. If I'm part of this government shutdown and then I'm going to run for re-election next year, then I'm going to have a problem.
Yeah, I don't know that I can call any specific Democrats out that would be willing to do the right thing here, but I do think, actually, maybe what happens is that some that are not up for re-election, that can just do what they think is the right thing for the country, they may actually be the ones that end up turning and voting with the Republicans to reopen the government.
You know, it's funny, too, Preston. One other mentioned that this senator that I just cannot stand, Ron Wyden, one of the most senior Democrats in the U.S. Senate. He lives in New York City, claims to represent a state 3,000 miles away. And he did a post today criticizing the ballroom that President Trump is adding. And there have been a bunch of presidents that have added on to the White House over the last 200 years. And so you say, and your problem with this one is that Trump, he mentions that SNAP and other programs run out of money on November 1. And I thought, yeah, and the ballroom money is not coming from the taxpayers. It's just giving President Trump another opportunity to point out it's all being privately funded. That's Preston Brashears, who is with the Grover Herman Center for the Federal Budget. Preston, thanks so much for the time. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey there, it's Lars.
Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And talk about provocative. A decision that a nude beach at Denny Blaine Park, this is in the Seattle area, a King County judge has decided that Seattle has done enough to curb the kind of behavior that neighbors of this park, a public park, were calling illegal and lewd, and I'd have to agree with them. They have decided somehow that Denny Blaine Park is a park which is a safe space and that it's clothing optional for people in the LGBTQ community. Why don't we just be blunt about it? Based on what I've seen described of this park, I I don't know if I've ever been to Denny Blaine Park. I don't recall ever being there, but I've been to many places in the Seattle metro area. But it is the city's longtime unofficial nude beach. Not exactly the kind of thing that would have drawn my attention. But apparently the neighbors were making a fairly, I think a fairly reasonable request. If you've got people from the gay community that are going down and using this public park for sex acts, then we don't want to be part of this, and we want the city to shut it down. And the city apparently decided not to. And then it was taken to a judge. And the group of neighbors sued the city and the Parks Department back in April of this year to shut down the beach altogether. And the judge, Samuel Chung, sided with the city, saying that the city's effort in the park, including fencing off a designated clothing optional area, adding signage about park rules, and then increasing staffing, had abated the issues enough to keep the nude beach open until the next court hearing. Chung's decision, and this is from the, I think it's from Como News, marked a victory for the city, which had pledged to address the lewd behavior at the park while preserving the nude beach, a hub of what they call safety and community, cherished by Seattle's LGBTQ plus community. You know, this is where regular average citizens who just want to live their lives and enjoy, you know, living in their home, living in their neighborhood. For more than 2 years, the people who lived within the vicinity of this 2-acre park had complained about the kind of behavior, including public masturbation, indecent exposure, and sex. In the April lawsuit, the anonymous neighbors said that Seattle Parks and Rec was mismanaging the park by allowing repeated lewd activity and illegal activity. And the judge said, no, the city hasn't stopped it altogether. In fact, if anything, by fencing off an area and saying this is the clothing optional area for this beach, they're actually aiding and abetting that kind of behavior. In any case, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. One last comment about Denny Blaine Park. As I admit, I don't think that I've ever been to this park, but the idea that there are some people in any community who decide that the way that they get their sexual satisfaction is going to very public places and then having sex with other people like this, in full view of apparently people who live in the neighborhood who might also want to use the park, is so selfish and so narcissistic, it really suggests that these people are behaving in an antisocial way. And when the city of Seattle says, we're not going to object to that, we're not going to shut it down, we're going to actually accommodate that kind of antisocial behavior, then what should the rest of the taxpaying citizens do? Speaking of antisocial behavior, let me mention this. An anti-ICE group called the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition is going to be moving into a vacant office space at the bottom floor of Gray's Landing. This is from Katie Davenport. It's an apartment building right across the street from where the ICE facility is in Southwest Portland. The non-governmental organization holds training on how to interfere with ICE operations and then offers tips to illegal aliens on how to evade ICE. Its members have been involved in an ongoing 24-hour Antifa occupation outside the ICE facility, which has resulted in the deployment, or the pending deployment, of the National Guard. And honestly, at this point, I hope that President Trump sends the National Guard to the city of Portland. He now has the court authority as of yesterday afternoon when the Ninth Circus Court decided that he has the authority and he can send the National Guard. Now, there was a letter that was obtained by a lady who puts her handle on social media is Honey Badger Mom. I read her stuff on a regular basis. She got hold of a letter. The letter shows that the city government of Portland worked with this Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition to move them into this building right across the street from ICE. Now, quite some time ago, the Trump administration had promised if there are governments out there, government officials out there that are aiding and abetting illegal aliens and obstructing the efforts, the legitimate efforts of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that those people are going to face charges. I think this might be the opportunity to say, we are going to shut this stuff down. And if you are a government official who has aided and abetted the illegal aliens, then you're going to face federal charges as well. We've already seen them do that with a couple of judges over the last 6 months or so. Oh, and one little update. U.S. Border Patrol and ICE have now arrested 51 illegal aliens with extensive criminal histories in Portland over the weekend. In other words, these are people who have extensive criminal histories. They are illegally in the United States, and they're in a sanctuary city. Why do you suppose they're attracted to a sanctuary city? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson
Security.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Washington State's largest wind project is now facing a major setback because wind projects tend to kill birds. And apparently, when they're endangered birds, finally we're seeing some common sense decisions. And one of them was just made by an agency that is known as the Washington State Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, otherwise known as FSEC. And what FSEC has done is dramatically scale back on a major wind energy project. I think the bloom is off the rose on this, just like it is for an awful lot of other, green nonsense, I guess is the best way to talk about it as one big problem. Because you'll remember that during Joe Biden, he got the Inflation Reduction Act, which didn't do anything to reduce inflation. But what it did provide was hundreds of billions of dollars for green energy projects that did not pencil out without the federal government writing gigantic checks. So that's the backdrop. Well, now an awful lot of that money has disappeared or is going to disappear at the end of this year or by the 1st of July of next year. That money is going to be gone. And I think a lot of the people behind the projects are starting to realize it. You're seeing that projects involving wave energy, tidal energy, wind energy, solar energy, all of these people behind these various industries, all of which we were promised were going to actually make financial sense at some point. You know, the idea was that you had to prime the pump. It was kind of Keynesian economics as applied to energy, that if you just put some money, and in this case, hundreds of billions of dollars into this industry, at some point it will be able to exist on its own. Except they're ignoring the history that almost every subsidized project continues to be subsidized. The only ones that actually end up penciling out tend to be the projects that are never subsidized. And I can give you a couple of examples of those that you'll be familiar with. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you here on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And this segment of the show comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them at 540training.com. Now, if you want to join the conversation, it's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question today, now that the Ninth Circus Court of Appeals down in San Francisco, usually they're reliably liberal. In this case, they made a fairly sensible decision. The question was put to them, can Donald Trump deploy the National Guard to troubled American cities? In particular, he was being asked about Portland, although the same question has been raised about Chicago in a different appeals court. Well, the Ninth Circus Court yesterday decided, yes, Donald Trump can call up the National Guard, and yes, he can send them to Portland. And in fact, I think he should send them to Portland to send the message. If a city, any American city, in this case Portland, which has sided with the Antifa rioters against ICE going all the way back to 2018, this didn't just start happening this year under Donald Trump. It has been happening for a long, long time. That if the city has decided we're going to allow people to lay siege to a federal agency because the people in that city who've decided to make a sanctuary city within a sanctuary state to protect illegal aliens, they need to get a message. If you've said, we will attack that building, we will break the windows, and they did, we will force the people inside to live at great peril to their life and safety. If you're going to do that, and if the city, and this has happened under two different mayors, not just spineless Keith Wilson, but also feckless Ted Wheeler. Ted Wheeler was the first guy who said he agreed with the people who were protesting outside of ICE and that he would protect their right to protest. Only when you protest in a way in which you actually block off access to the building to the point where it takes 20 people in full riot gear to be able to open the gates and let people in or out of the building, you're impeding the operations of ICE. And frankly, I think one of the solutions to this is not just a National Guard presence that's going to push back this nonsense of fireworks and attacks on the building, rocks thrown through windows, physical attacks on anybody who goes up to either take pictures of the Antifa types or any of that. If you were to send a message by, let's say, bringing federal charges against some of the city officials who made this happen, bring them against the police chief, bring them against the mayor. Now, I hear people with crazy suggestions about ideas all the time. I try to make my ideas somewhat sensible. And if I said, look, if you're getting in the way of federal law enforcement, does the president have an authority and a responsibility to make sure the laws are enforced? I'd remind you that while everybody remembers the part of the presidential oath about supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States, many people forget that part of that oath says that he will faithfully execute the laws of the United States of America. And frankly, I think it's kind of arrogant for both the city and the Antifa types to decide we don't like the law. So therefore, if we don't like a law, we will simply impede the police officers who've decided to enforce a law, police in this case being ICE. And you say, you don't like the law, go to Congress and get it changed. Well, we can't get it changed. No, and you're not going to get it changed. Most of those laws were written decades before Donald Trump ever ran for office. And no significant changes have been made in federal law. So when you hear people saying, well, this is Donald Trump's doing, actually, he's an American president who simply takes his responsibilities seriously to say, I've got the job. I'm going to faithfully execute the laws. The laws say you can't be illegally in the country. And as I pointed out to you, in the last weekend, 51 illegal aliens with extensive criminal records were arrested in the sanctuary city of Portland, Oregon over the weekend. Now, what does that tell you? In other words, those are the kinds of people that when you looked at the public opinion polls and people were asked, do you support the deportation of illegal aliens? Yes. Do you support the deportation of illegal aliens who are also guilty of crimes other than just being here illegally? You got an even stronger support. About two-thirds of Americans support that. So now that the appeals court says that Trump can deploy the National Guard, should he send them to the troubled cities like Chicago and Portland? Today's Expo is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, about what FSEC did, they scaled back the original Horse Heaven wind, solar, and battery project. And why? Because an endangered species of hawk is being slaughtered by these turbines. And they were originally proposing, under Jay Inslee, 222 of these turbines. FSEC approved most of the project, but cut about 36 of the turbines. I think we're going to see more of these things go by the wayside because the federal money isn't there anymore. And if you have any kind of business in which you only exist if you get a check from Washington, D.C., that business does not deserve to exist. And that includes wind and solar and all the other crazy energy schemes. If they can't exist without a subsidy, make them go away. And let's use the traditional energy that God has blessed this great country with. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Lauren.
just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. These days, foreigners come to America expecting us to adapt to their culture. Should they be required to embrace our culture instead? I think you know how I'm going to come down on that. In fact, I pointed out to you that there are plenty of good examples of countries that actually make a real effort to say you need to adapt to our culture, not the other way around. And I think a little bit of a warning comes from what is going on in Western Europe right now as they face a flood of refugees and immigrants who are coming in mostly from the Middle East. And there are some great examples. And one of them I saw the other day, and I'll share some of it with you in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, hey, we're going to put naysayers right to the head of the list the way we always have at 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our poll on X. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, my website. Now, about this, I read this piece and I thought this was fascinating because it really is a warning. When you watch what is going on in Western Europe, there are Islamic rape gangs. Now, in Great Britain, you don't see a lot written about that because they've literally made it illegal. They have no First Amendment rights in Great Britain and other countries. So you don't see a lot of reporters that are covering the problem. And in fact, if people get on social media and they are critical of rape gangs that all seem to be centered around a particular religious faith, and that is Islam, if you even mention that on social media, you can literally face arrest and imprisonment for the crime of speaking out against it. But listen to this. Immigrants are no longer expected to melt into American culture. That's true. In fact, even the suggestion of it is supposedly racist. A wide-ranging data set out of the Netherlands went viral this morning. This was from a couple of days ago. It shows that immigrants from Somalia end up being a net drain on the Dutch economy. At the same time, it shows that North American and Japanese migrants are a net gain for the economy. Now, I've told you the same thing is true in the United States. There are people who can't, I think, see past the end of their noses who say, well, aren't these immigrants going to be a gain for our economy? In fact, there are some people who try to say, well, if all these people are paying taxes, and that's an open question, in many cases, they're working under the table, which means they're not paying taxes. And if they're paying into Social Security, and in many cases, they're not paying into Social Security, but there's really no way to prove it one way or the other. Because if somebody works under the table and doesn't file federal taxes, then there's no way to find out where was that money going? Were they actually paying taxes on it? This piece goes on to say, in fact, most everywhere that doesn't have a native Western culture ends up being a massive net drag on the economy. Arab, African, Southwest Asian, Afghanistan, etc., and all of the Arab states, all in the toilet as far as becoming contributing members of the Dutch economy. One estimate put the lifetime cost of the roughly 43,000 Somalis living in the Netherlands at about 50 billion euro, meaning, yes, they will work there. Yes, they will earn salaries there. But there's a net cost because you have inputs, you have outputs. It depends on whether or not you're a net contributor. You could think about this in your own family. If you have somebody who's a child, is that child contributing economically to the family? No, but you don't expect them to. But if you have the deadbeat brother-in-law who sits on your front couch and he takes food out of your refrigerator and lives in your house, he's a net drain. He's not contributing anything, and he is taking things. That's what's going on. They say only one in 10 Somalis in the UK is employed at this point. More than a quarter of Eritreans and just over 1 in 5 Somalis are in prison in Scotland. And what about the United States? The piece goes on to say, did you see the story about the depressed Pennsylvania town with a population of 4,000 that imported 2,000 Haitians to work in a factory? The company defaulted. The factory closed down. There are now 2,000 unemployed Haitians with no legal status living in that small Pennsylvania town. He points out that you have to expect that people are going to be in the melting pot and that they're going to assimilate to your culture, but you see more and more signs in America that's not happening. And if it doesn't start happening, then I think the United States is in big trouble. Let's go to Linda Hey, Linda, thanks for the call. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm wondering why all of these people that are voting to keep the aliens in and the drug runners, illegal immigrants, excuse me, why don't they take a family in and just support them the rest of their lives and take the burden off of the government?
I think because they believe it is society's job. And it's really easy. You know, don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax that guy behind the tree. They always think, I want to do this because it's the right thing to do, but I don't want to actually pay the personal cost of that. I think that's what they'd tell you if you were able to ask them that. You say, okay, you want all these illegal aliens to come into America. Why? Well, because they want to come here from a, you know, a country that's worse than the United States, which is every other country on the planet. And if you say, well, right, how many can we possibly take in? And they don't seem to have an idea of what is the right number. And I ask people that all the time, Linda. I point out to people, when President Reagan was president in the 80s, we took in about 300,000 plus legal immigrants to the United States. The number went up to about 600,000 under Bill Clinton. It went above a million under Barack Obama. So which one of those numbers is right? And I get people saying, well, what difference does it make? As though the United States has an unlimited or infinite carrying capacity. That, you know, if you said, if you and your husband or you and your sweetheart live in a nice size house, and your husband comes home and says, hey, my buddy from work, he just got kicked out by his girlfriend. Can he sleep in our back bedroom? And you might say, yeah, we got space. Go ahead. Tell him to bed down. And then when he brings home five people, and you say, honey, we don't have room for that many people. You know, at some point you hit the carrying load capacity. I think America's already hit it. We are short of housing. We are short of nurses. We're short of doctors. We're short of medical care. Every government in this country says we're short of money. We don't have enough money to do the right thing. And for example, when you see that the Democrats want us to commit to $1.5 trillion, and a big chunk of that is to pay for medical insurance for illegal aliens. And if you say, hold on, we're short of money in a bunch of critical areas, whether it's education, whether it's the military, to serve our own citizens, and now you're telling me you want to spend billions, hundreds of billions of dollars providing medical insurance for people who are illegally in the country, you can't do both. You can't say, you know, we don't have enough money to meet the needs of Americans, but we have plenty of cash to meet the needs of people who don't even have a right to be here. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. But, you know, our government is totally out of whack. You know, it's just like I've tried to get a doctor's appointment. I had to wait 3 months.
Yep.
You know, it's just terrible. And I think bombing these boats that are coming over with the fentanyl and all of that, that should be done. And I don't understand why some people are saying, well, we got to go through this, we got to go through that before we can do it. That's to me idiotic.
It is. And you know, Linda, I'm blessed because I haven't lost a family member to a drug overdose, but there are so many American families that have. How do you suppose those American families feel about the idea of bombing the drug dealers out of existence? I'll bet they're all for it. Linda, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. The work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm starting to see some of the effects of getting all the illegal aliens out of America. Now, we've only seen about 2 million people either self-deport or be deported by the Trump administration, but hey, he's got 4 years or 3.5 more years to go, and I figure he can get a lot done. But what positive effect does that have? I pointed out to people, it should start to unclog our schools. It should start to lessen the load on hospitals and emergency rooms. And there's another area, housing, where it's already starting to have an effect. And John Binder has written a great story about it at Breitbart.com. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And in fact, John, you work as the immigration-specific reporter, so this is your beat.
It is, yes. I do this day in and day out.
Well, I'm glad to see it because there are so many aspects to this. I want you to tell my audience what has started to happen specifically, not just because of deportation, but because of policy changes in housing and urban development, specifically about FHA home loans.
Right. So months ago, the Trump administration filed a new regulation which basically bars migrants from seeking FHA loans. These are the government-backed mortgage loans that migrants under the Biden administration flocked to and, you know, drove up huge demand for housing, which is why under the Biden administration, you know, we were constantly being told that inflation was cooling, inflation was coming down, and yet housing inflation and home prices, rent prices, were skyrocketing. And that is because of immigration. It is a supply and demand issue. And so what the Trump administration did is bar migrants from seeking FHA loans. And we are starting to see the initial results of that since that federal regulation went into effect some months ago, where it has just plummeted the number of migrants filing applications for FHA loans. And these are not just illegal aliens that were applying for FHA loans previously, but these are also foreign nationals who are on temporary work visas. And we have countless number of foreign nationals in the United States who come on temporary work visas and somehow indefinitely remain in the United States. It is a huge problem. And everyone that comes to the U.S. has to be housed. Everyone needs housing. And that drives up demand. It makes it so that Americans are essentially competing against the world for houses. And it's partially why young people my age, have suffered so much in the housing market, cannot get even a foot in the door in terms of owning their own home. To so many young Americans, that is a pipe dream. And should that really be the case? That is something that we as Americans should ask ourselves. And how can limiting immigration reduce that demand?
By the way, I want you to explain a couple of things to my audience. I think I understand them reasonably well, but I want you to explain them. But I'm talking to John Binder. You can read his stories at Breitbart.com. And H-1B visa holders, refugees, asylees, and DACAs, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which, by the way, the courts have decided was an illegal action by President Obama. But once it was put in place, even though it was illegal, it was difficult to undo it. But when you mention FHA or government-backed loans, in other words, it's kind of like having a cosigner. If you were a kid and you want to buy a car and you don't have any credit, so you go to mom and dad and say, hey, would you be my cosigner on this loan? It's like having Uncle Sam be your cosigner because Uncle Sam, the government, is saying if John goes south on this loan, you know, he disappears or doesn't make the payments, then the government will back them up. That makes the loan much more creditworthy, probably gets you a better rate, and probably gets you approved where you on your own, I'm not talking about you, John, in particular, but I'm just using you as an example, that you'd be told, John, we're not loaning you $500,000 for a home. You don't have the credit. Oh, you've got Uncle Sam backing you. Okay, sure. This is what we were doing for people who we didn't even know if they were going to be here next week.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And are many Americans, I mean, they are living their lives. They have normal day jobs. I mean, not everyone can keep up with the news as much as you and I can, Lars. Many Americans have no idea that this is even going on. I get so many comments from people saying, well, I don't understand. How can someone get here on a visa and immediately secure a loan for a mortgage? Like, how does that work? And the process you just described is exactly how it works. And this also gets to a broader question, which is not only, you know, does immigration so deeply impact our housing market and rent prices, but should the federal government be in the business of prioritizing foreign nationals for mortgage loans over American citizens? Part of the privilege of being an American citizen is that you were supposed to be prioritized by your own government, as any nation state would prioritize their own citizens ahead of the citizens of a foreign country. And that's the other aspect of this. Why is it that for so many decades, migrants have been able to come to the United States, secure FHA-backed loans? And I'm sorry, Trump is the only one that is now doing something about this. Like, why was this not even being talked about from other Republicans? J.D. Vance had been talking about it for quite some time since joining the Senate, but you did not hear this from any Republicans.
Nope.
Trump is the first one to do something.
Well, and probably because a lot of banks love this, because they'll say, yeah, we'll issue a mortgage because I got Uncle Sam to fall back on. But if you walked into a bank and said, hi, I'd like to get a mortgage loan, they say, oh, okay, where do you work? Well, I might not have a job yet, or I do have a job. And they said, well, are you legally in the country? Well, no. Do you have a right to work a job? No. Which means you can lose your job anytime. That sounds like one of the worst credit risks that anybody would ever look at. And then to have that person say, I'd like $400,000 to buy a house. And you say, mm-hmm. And we don't even know if you will have your job, because you could be removed from your job and even removed from the country, you know, in a month or a week or a day. And then where are we supposed to go? It kind of makes me curious what's happening to all the FHA-backed loans that were made to illegal aliens who've now been deported. Are those homes just falling back into the hands of the bank that has to then
right.
deal with a repo home?
And a Republican-controlled committee in the House or the Senate should be investigating this. This is a no-brainer. To think that this has been going on, like I said, for how many decades, no one has done anything about it, and now Trump finally does something about it. And what do we have? We have the Mortgage Brokers Association and the big banks asking, pleading with the Trump administration, please do not impose this policy. This is not because the Mortgage Brokers Association is concerned for the well-being of our illegal and legal immigrant population. It is because of money. And that is why the big banks, the Mortgage Brokers Association, are so ingratiated in the open borders movement, because it's bad for ordinary Americans. It is great for anyone doing business on behalf of these folks.
I mean, people should understand that every time a bank writes a loan, whether it's to a citizen or to a complete illegal alien with no right to work, that bank makes money on issuing that loan and servicing that loan. So you say, well, why would they make a loan to somebody who might just be yanked out and deported from the country? Because if the loan goes south, FHA backs it up. So they don't have to worry. It's like the cosigner. When John stops making the payments on his car, we go to John's mom and say, now, Mom, you have to make the payments. Only in this case, Mom is Uncle Sam. You can read the story by John Binder. He's a reporter on immigration issues, specifically at Breitbart.com. John, thanks very, very much. Back in a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Are you?
He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist. That's Oregon Medical Centers. And our ex-poll today, now that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals says Trump can deploy the National Guard, should he send them to troubled American cities? I'd answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. And brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go to Steve in Gig Harbor, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI, one of our great affiliates. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so what you guys are chatting about, this is the same group of people who are buying houses in the subprime days in 2006 that caused the housing crisis,
yep.
who had no job, no down payment, and no credit, terrible credit or whatever.
The ones that they called ninja loans, no income, no jobs, no assets?
Yep. And those three people who were in charge of all of it, Barney Frank sleeping with a guy from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, I mean, it's the CFO, and they're handing out houses to people right and left. This is more of the same.
Well, it's with one significant difference, but not in a positive way. The subprime mortgage problem was that they were issuing all these mortgages, and they were subprime. They weren't very good credit. And there wasn't a very good likelihood you'd get paid back. Now, ordinarily, that would not be viewed as a good loan, but they would package the loans up. It'd be like this, Steve. If I took a package of sort of mediocre hamburger and I wrapped it up in white paper and I wrote grade A steak on the outside of the package, as long as you never open the package, you think, well, Lars just sold me a package of grade A steak. And if somebody else said, hey, I'd like some steak, you say, well, I'll sell you this package. Lars says it's grade A. They had government agencies that were agreeing to say this is grade A loans, and they weren't. They were junk loans. But as long as nobody ever opened them up, then nobody ever found out.
But when they reneged on the loans, they got opened, and then they sold those packages of steak in giant bundles to countries all over the world. And when the house of cards fell apart, guess what happened to economies worldwide? Because somebody in the government was demanding, based on the Glass-Steagall and the Community Reinvestment Act back in the Clinton days, demanded that people make these loans, these subprime loans,
yep, they
to
did.
Neighborhoods and places that had very little ownership in houses.
And we got the same kind of thing going on now, Steve, because at the time, when they said, you have to make these loans, the bank said, look, we make loans based on creditworthiness. And they said, well, that's racist because you're saying that these people right. are not creditworthy. And many of them, a disproportionate number, are brown and black. And you say, so it's racist. Yeah. No, you're not looking at somebody's skin color. You're saying, do you have a job? Right. Do you have a good income? Do you have a record of paying your bills on time? I mean, somebody who's black or brown or white or any color can be very good at their credit or very bad at their credit. But the right. banks were shamed into making loans they never should have made. This is worse, though, because this is the government. The government agency saying make these loans to illegal aliens who don't even have a right to work a job.
That's right. Meanwhile, Maxine Waters, Chris Dodd, Frank never got hauled in front of anybody. John from Arizona tried to make a big deal in front of the Senate with these loans were happening a year before. And Barney Frank said, everything's fine, John McCain. Don't yep. worry about it. Don't worry about it. It wasn't fine. And these three people got away with it scot-free. And
well, look what Trump is correcting, though. If he's saying to FHA, you're not going to make loans to H-1Bs. You're not going to make loans to illegal aliens. You're not going to make loans to people who are DACA. Now, all of a sudden, and what John Binder's story, and the reason I found it so interesting, I own a house. All of my producers would tell you, I encourage every one of them, buy a house when you can. I mean, don't buy at a stupid price, but buy a house when you can, and 10 years from now, you'll be thrilled, because the payment you think is tough today will look like easy pickings 10 years from now. I mean, all of us can look back and say, boy, if I'd bought a house then, I'd have a locked-in, mortgage of, $1,800 a month, and today $1,800 would look like a bargain. But in this case, if illegal aliens are taking these loans and all of a sudden they're locked out of FHA loans, do you know who that makes room for? Every single American citizen, every single green card holder is now has an easier time getting an FHA-backed loan. It also means that the housing market, if you have all these illegal aliens and the only way they're able to get those loans to buy the houses is FHA, then what happens is when FHA says we're not loaning to illegals anymore, then that house becomes available to an American citizen. Let's go to Jason. Jason, you're going to have to be quick because we're about a minute to the break. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how you doing? I know that, I smell these guys' wicked moves every time they make one. And this is just another move of the worldwide deep state to try to collapse the economy in some way.
How does it collapse the economy to say we're not going to loan to people who might get deported next week? Dump, dump, dump. When you use language like that, Jason, you get banned from the show. 94.10. Thank you very much, Jason. You're not getting on again. Not when you drop those kind of words. That gets me in trouble with the FCC. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.